Welcome back to Callum and David's Any Requests podcast. This is, of course, our podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month via our Patreon subscription service and request us to do a podcast on absolutely anything you want.
That is, of course, entirely correct, as it is every week. I don't know why I have to say it, but it's, you know, it's become a thing now.
Well, it wasn't correct last week because we didn't do one.
No, this is absolutely true. Thank you. I'm sure you're all hugely... left bereft from not having us accompany you on your Monday morning non-commutes or commutes from the bedroom to the kitchen, however you're handling a lockdown life at the moment, but not long.
That's what threw me off slightly doing that intro this week. So I always say weekly, and I was about to say weekly, and then I thought, well, it's not, because we missed a week.
I knew there was something there. There was a slight hesitation.
That's what happened.
But this is a really, really interesting request.
We'll get sued.
We probably will.
False advertising.
Is it? I mean, well, technically, yeah. I mean, it's a good job we don't make any money off this, really, isn't it? I say that. I'm not being ungrateful for your £5 a month. Thank you very much, patrons. This week is a really unique request. You know, we've had quite a few music-themed requests recently, and we're kind of returning to that soon as well, which we have great fun with, especially with our expert guest, Joshua Benfield, the sexiest man on Britain's mastermind.
Absolutely.
I don't know if there is an American mastermind.
It's probably been syndicated internationally.
Probably, yeah. But this week, we are talking about the no hugging, no learning sitcom model.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this comes from Ben. Thank you very much for this request this time. Really fun. Yeah. Ostensibly, the genre or trope, if you like, of the no hugging, no learning sitcom comes directly from Seinfeld. And it was a direct quote of Larry David, one of the co-creators of Seinfeld, who on day one in the writer's room said he only had two rules about this show: no hugging and no learning, i.e. the characters do not change fundamentally. They cannot learn, kind of, you know, as with a lot of kind of, especially in America, 70s and 80s, sitcoms often had quite big moral messages, and there'd sort of be learning experiences in each episode, and there'd be a kind of moral of the story. And there'd be quite a lot of emotional kind of stuff going on as well. And David just said, I don't want either of those things to take place. Other than that, we can do whatever we want. Which then lent to Seinfeld kind of being famously known as the show about nothing. Because if you take away emotional development or plot development, you're not really left with anything. And that's what Seinfeld was, and became a huge hit because of that. Now, I don't know where, Ben, you're writing in from. I'd be interested, because I think it's probably, we'll come across this, I think, in the podcast, more of an American trope than it is a British one. And in fact, Seinfeld itself is interesting in terms of one of very few series I can think of, not just in comedy, but just in general television, that is such an iconic, beloved show. But kind of only in America. Like, it really didn't break here that much. I mean, it's really shown here and things like that, and people know of it. But, you know, I can't say I've particularly ever sat down to watch Seinfeld. I don't know many people that have. And yet, it's a huge kind of backbone of American pop culture.
Yeah, and I think when you think, you know, it's difficult to talk about... Seinfeld and what has, as you kind of quite rightly say, and I think it's fair to say, the genre of kind of no hugging or subgenre of sitcom, situation comedy, wouldn't really exist without Seinfeld, but that wouldn't really exist without the status quo to rebel against. And I think quite obvious sitcoms we now think of in America actually come post Seinfeld, but they're modeled off things like Full House, family situation comedies, where you have kind of every kind of man-esque, every kind of day type people struggling their way through life, and very kind of obvious, palatable, middle of the road comedy. And there's nothing wrong with that. I say that with no disdain at all. But it was kind of years. I think that can go back quite far, right? If you think of kind of old black and white television series, you know.
Yeah.
That were often based around comedians. You know, they had comedians playing famous characters.
The Honeymooners is the big famous one in America. Jackie Gleason, is it? Bang Zoom to the Moon.
The catchphrase as well. Yeah. And things like I Love Lucy. You know, nodding. You know, to that kind of thing. Yeah. So
Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you think about that coming out of, really the 50s and 60s, comedy was huge. Anything that kind of made people laugh. And also on the back of the Second World War, people were kind of going for that. And times were tough and you had, economic strife. And then you had the kind of the 80s, right? And this huge kind of period of excess and economic supposed quote-unquote security, for whom is a different question, but you know, the cultural attitude of both America and Britain was very much excess, you know, whether it was Harry Enfield and chums, loads of money, you know, as a coming out of that 80s culture, or with Seinfeld, where actually there wasn't much to kind of moan about in the same way that there had been more traditionally before. So you've got a sitcom based around a comedian like Jerry Seinfeld, who, make no mistake, it was huge. Whether you like him or hate him, and he can be very divisive, and actually, for me personally, depending on what point of career he's in, you have a comedian that's basing comedy when you're not really railing against anything and raging against the machine, as kind of comedians kind of famously do. So I think it's a fascinating concept, one, to try and do a sitcom like that, but also it makes sense that you're taking the character of Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian, and having to put him into a situation where you can't really put him in real life. You can't put him into an Aristotelian tragic kind of story arc where everyone kind of learns something and there are trials and tribulations and everyone kind of makes up at the end and recoups and resets for the next episode.
Yeah.
You can't really do that culturally. So I think that's probably why it hit people so hard. And it was quite divisive in the press, wasn't it? The critics were not necessarily all that over Seinfeld.
Not originally, no. And that's kind of... It's funny, it's still even now referred to as a cult classic, which is weird for one of the most successful sitcoms of all time. I mean, you're talking about multi-millionaires in Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention the cast. And, you know, it ran from, I think, 89 to 98, 9 seasons, 180 episodes. So past that, for those who don't know, once you get past 100 episodes in US television, it means you can be syndicated. Which means you can rerun again and again and again. And that's the kind of magic number you want to get to when you create a series, because that just means you never have to work again, because you're getting those residuals every time that's shown. Very much, a TV show that's still shown today. In the early years, because I suppose the closest thing... Because really, you're not wrong in terms of almost exclusively US sitcom before that was the sort of 2.4 children, not the British sitcom 2.4 children, the family dynamic.
The statistical kind of,
the nuclear family, based sitcoms, things like Married with Children. But I suppose the closest thing probably would be Cheers. Pre-Seinfeld, in terms of being, you know, Cheers being really the first sitcom that focused on an ensemble rather than a kind of family unit, where there was largely, because it was the 80s and sexist and pre that, you know, it would focus on the man of the house and then layers down peripherally for the kind of rest of the family in terms of how important they were, but generally the central protagonist would be the father.
And then by the time, you know, British sitcoms were kind of, you had literally Man About the House, famous, or Boys in the Black stuff, you know, sitcoms about definitely men and what they're up to.
Yeah.
And then these kind of secondary female characters who actually were holding everything together.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call Boys from the Black stuff a sitcom.
No.
Gritty Northern drama, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't mean Boys from the Black stuff. I'm thinking of The Likely Lads.
Right,
which is entirely different. Sorry.
Bernard Hill going around trying to get a job. And yeah,
I don't
social
mean
social commentary about Northern working class.
I mean,
I'd not exactly
quite like to see
sitcom.
That.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, played for laughs. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it's so Cheers came along, and in terms of being, although still very much focused on Sam and Diane in the early years before Kirstie Alley came into it, it is still, you know, Norm and Cliff and Woody and Rhea Perlman's character behind Carla behind the bar,
yeah,
and Frasier, obviously. And they're all important, and they all anchor certain episodes. And I guess that was the first, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and any listeners out there, but to my knowledge, that was the first, certainly US sitcom that did that, that it was ensemble based. And so I guess in that way, that's,
yeah,
probably the only thing I could say that was around pre-Seinfeld of that model. But even then, Cheers is very much a Hugging and Learning sitcom.
Absolutely. And beautifully executed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, from start to finish, there's a really clear story arc. And the same with Frasier, which is obviously the spin-off from that different kind of setup in terms of focusing on that one character. And but still, like, I mean, it's kind of epic. Brilliant writing,
yeah.
Packed into a half-hour sitcom model, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Very difficult to achieve, but yeah, to then completely rail against that is just obtuse. I mm-hmm. mean, how they thought it was going to go down, is remarkable. But then knowing what we know about Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld now, maybe it takes two people that stubborn and that confident in their own vision to be able to pull something like that off.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of imposing those two rules, if you talk about, you know, no one's going to have an emotional arc across a season,
mm-hmm.
No one's going to learn any fundamental values or change fundamentally. If you impose that, what actually happens is a huge amount of freedom, actually.
Yeah.
If you think of those two rules as being quite restrictive, it's actually the opposite, because once you impose those things, it means you can kind of do anything you want because you're not structuring anything.
Yeah.
You're just kind of going, let's see what happens. And as such, with a show like Seinfeld, you've got a hell of a lot of meta televisual stuff going on. I think it's season 4 where George and Jerry get the opportunity to pitch a sitcom, and they pitch a sitcom about fictionalized versions of themselves doing nothing.
Yeah.
So you go, hang on, there's so layers here.
My brain. But
yeah. You know, or you get episodes like we watched one in prep for this podcast, one of the most kind of iconic ones, which is the Chinese restaurant, which is what's, I think we've mentioned it before, commonly known as a bottle episode,
yes,
where it's in real time in one location. And there's quite a few bottle episodes throughout the 9 seasons of Seinfeld, because what better way to do an episode about nothing than to have no time, than to have 30 minutes worth of a snapshot of someone's life?
Yeah.
You know?
I just side note, I love bottle episodes, yeah, of anything. Yeah.
I mean,
any
just
drama,
more like theatre, I think that's
comedy. Maybe that is because we, you know, we're theatre, yeah, makers at heart, and that's where our roots are. I love, you know, we're constantly trying to put things in small cheap sets, right? No,
yeah,
set changes,
yeah,
no costume changes. But at the same time, there's something so, as you say, restrictive about it, because characters can go to places where the audience wouldn't necessarily allow them to do that, you know.
Yeah. I think my favorite ever bottle episode of a TV show, and I cannot remember which season it comes in, but it's an episode of Family Guy.
Are you talking about Stewie and Brian?
Yeah, I'm talking about
In
Stewie.
The Bank.
Yeah,
that's absolutely one of my favorite.
Right.
I think probably my favorite as well.
It's phenomenal.
It's
a phenomenal
piece
of writing.
Bits.
Yeah,
I was in,
yeah,
absolute,
yeah,
bits. I was like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
I don't even like Family Guy that much.
Yeah. It's
like, it's great. Family's quite great.
One of the most honest. This is ridiculous. We're talking about a talking dog and a talking baby in a cartoon, but it's one of the most honest portrayals of alcoholism and depression.
Yeah.
When Brian starts actually talking about all these problems that he had, it's beautifully written and really sensitively done, and it's
phenomenal.
It's amazing.
And the dependency issue of Stewie being,
yeah,
like, I don't want to rely on people, but I have to, and this is why, yeah, I'm so conflicted and an evil, evil child,
yeah,
with a vendetta against killing my mother. Like,
yeah,
it is beautiful. And at the end, and the gun, the element of the gun in the vault. Ah, oh. Anyway, if you want to go see a really good piece of theatre,
Yeah.
Go, just don't. Go watch that episode of Van de Grey instead. Because it's a masterclass in, in how to do a bottle.
I think it's like maybe, act. I want to say seasons, it's between like 6 and 9, I think. It's somewhere around there.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, if you type in Family Guy bottle episode to Drew Bryan, you'll find it.
So good.
But yeah.
Brilliant. I love you, Brian.
Yeah, as I say, that kind of structure, when you're doing a sitcom about nothing, where no one could learn anything, it's perfect because you have a very finite amount of time. So
yeah,
why try and make something that's going to be, you know, you've got to be pretty lucky in life to have some kind of fundamental learning experience in 30 minutes, yeah. You know. So you get an episode like The Chinese Restaurant where, actually read the blurb. The blurb of this online of this episode of the breakdown. And it's literally like, George is waiting for the phone to be free and Jerry sees someone he thinks he recognises. I was like, that is it. That's the episode.
And Judy Louise Rapers is hungry.
That's it.
That is literally the whole thing. One of the things I love about that particular episode is that it's so well structured.
Yeah.
Because it is still structured, mm-hmm. kind of like a three-act play, but instead of following the natural story, it kind of tricks you into thinking this is going to happen again. But actually, it's going to go somewhere. But actually, the same thing just happens again.
Yeah.
Like, oh, George is still frustrated by the phone. Or Jerry's still wondering about that. And there's actually a point where they all repeat their lines again, where Jerry says, George says, oh, when is this phone going to be free? And Jerry says, where do I know that woman from? And Julia Louisa looked at the driver and says, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And I just thought, they're doing that every 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just takes you back to what the characters are about, which is the opposite of dramatic writing, but in the same places that dramatic writing would require that device.
Totally. Totally. I'm really glad you brought up structure, because I think, as you say, one of the most important things you have to have if you're going to create a show about nothing is structure. Mm. It has to be the illusion of nothing. And, you know, Ben's asked us to talk about the evolution of the No Hugging, No Learning sitcom. So kind of moving, we'll probably come back to it, but moving past Seinfeld, in terms of kind of chronologically, if you want to go pretty much, I think it was 99 or 2000 when it started, you have to go to Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is of course Larry David again, and it's again a fictionalized version of Larry David in a fictional world. All the other characters are played by actors and actresses. It's not his real wife, it's not his real manager, it's, you know, although there are people like Richard Lewis, the comedian and actor, playing his real best friend, and he is his real best friend in real life as well. So there's, again, there's weird layers of kind of blending reality and fiction in that. But if you talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm being kind of a move on from Seinfeld in terms of that it was largely completely improvised.
Yeah.
So if, again, you're going to do another show about nothing, you take that to the next level. You don't even give the actors a script. You give them a very basic framework. Anyone that knows the films of Christopher Guest might know that he works in a very similar way. You basically, as an actor, you get a storyboard and you go, these are the beats that have to happen in this episode. Other than that, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, the structure is even more important than it was in Seinfeld. Yes. So the structure of that storyboard is a work of art in Curb Your Enthusiasm. The way that he will drop a hint of something that you think is completely irrelevant in the first 5 minutes of the episode that ends up tying everything up at the end, and how things are weaved through and repeated, and motifs and a sight gag that you think is a throwaway thing ends up being the crux of the whole episode. It's absolute structural genius.
And that's Larry David's thing, right? Yes. And I think that's one of the things that's important to notice in Seinfeld, is that if you like Jerry Seinfeld's comedy, you'll, you know, and you've watched all of his material, then you'll be aware of the hour and a half set that he's written over 35 years of his career. Yeah. It is very, very neat, tidy, brilliant joke writing. But that on its own actually isn't very sustainable.
No.
When you've got Jerry Seinfeld married with Larry David, and Larry David is the head writer and running that writer's room and the exec producer, you realize how important that structure is, because when you see Jerry Seinfeld without that structure over the course of, you know, a body of like a stand-up session that's more than 10 minutes long, you really see where it suffers, because it's kind of hard to take people who aren't that likable for that long unless you move us on right at the moment where we've had enough.
Yeah.
And that, I think, Curb Your Enthusiasm does better than anything in the world.
Yeah.
I much prefer it to Seinfeld.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Which, you know, some people might go, oh, how can you say that? Well, actually kind of makes sense because he did Seinfeld first. Yeah. So this is the better version.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny, and I'm sure I always didn't feel this way. And actually, I think maybe with something like Friends, it doesn't grate on me so much. But canned laughter really gets on my nerves in Seinfeld. And I think maybe because Friends was filmed in front of a live studio audience, so it's slightly different and it makes sense, and you believe that those people are actually laughing at that point. You kind of know that Seinfeld wasn't, and so there's something odd about the humor of Seinfeld mixed with canned laughter makes it quite odd.
I completely agree, and I think that there's also probably something to do with the fact that it's dated. If Seinfeld was made today, I don't think they would have canned laughter for a second.
It was
the language of comedy back then.
Yeah.
And you only have to look at modern comedies that you and I adore, and you kind of go, oh, there's no canned laughter at all.
And also, I guess for me as well, Curb is, you know, so much... Like, I learned quite a lot about how the American film industry works from watching Curb Your Enthusiasm as a teenager. Just being like, oh, okay, you know, because so much is obviously about Larry's work, which is in the film industry in Hollywood. So you get kind of a lot of insight into that. And what I will say is season 4, which is when he gets cast alongside Ben Stiller to open the producers on Broadway.
Yeah.
The final episode of season 4, for my money, is one of the most accurate portrayals of what it's like just before a show opens.
Yeah.
And I've never... You watch that as someone that's in the theatre industry and you will feel nervous because they capture it so perfectly. And again, I think that's because they are so free to improvise. They're free with, again, this no hugging, no learning idea that they're not having to get to a point in terms of plot or in terms of emotional arc, that they can really just feel things in the moment.
Yeah.
And that kind of rawness makes it so real and so realistic.
Yeah.
And that was used to great effect in that season. And as someone in the theatre world, it's just a joy to watch that actually be realised instead of...
Hollywoodised.
Yeah, instead of watching Glee or something. But
Yeah, very, very true. Curb Your Enthusiasm is probably, you know, the blueprint of... Like, the perfect example of the no-hugging, no-learning genre that David invented through Seinfeld. And, I adore it for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons I think is really interesting, though, is that you discovered it as a teenager. I discovered it, I think, actually through you at college, drama school.
No, incorrect. I will tell you where you discovered it.
Where did I discover it?
You discovered it. I showed it to you when we went on holiday with my parents and my sister to the south of France.
There
in
you
that
are.
Villa, and I took a load of DVDs with me, and I was like, it's time for you to watch Curb Your Enthusiasm now.
And there we are. A little insight into the history of Callum and David.
Yeah.
But I loved it. And then a few years later...
It was a good holiday, that was.
It was a great holiday. Yeah, I got a job on that holiday. Got a phone call. First professional acting job.
You did. Not like you didn't get a job out in France.
Yeah, I became a French maid. Cleaned rooms and chateaus.
I fell in love with a busker from afar. And she captured my heart.
Yeah, she played me and Bobby McGee.
She did.
And you never... That was it.
I was in
Didn't
love.
Didn't you become replacement friends with her?
Mm.
Which is pretty much the equivalent of, like, getting engaged, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And we did get engaged.
Did you?
Yeah, I forgot to say that.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
a couple of years later, a friend of mine came to me, Jesse, who we both know, theatre director, and he said he would have been about 47, 48 at the time, and he came to me and said, Callum, oh my goodness, I can't believe I've just discovered this amazing thing. Have you ever heard of Curb Your Enthusiasm? I was like, yes, I'm all over it. And then a couple of years ago, someone else about the same age came to me and said, oh my God, I've just discovered Paul, actually. Mm. I've just discovered Curb Your Enthusiasm. Do you know? I was like, yes, I do. But why are you all these middle-aged men discovering it at all different points? and really relating to it. And I also kind of worry. I'm going, oh, do you think Larry David's the hero?
Yeah.
Because he isn't. But also, because no one is.
But also, I worry about people discovering it at this point, especially people in this country, and thinking that it's copying Jack the Lead Balloon. It's the other way around.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Probably worth acknowledging. Lead Balloon, sitcom with Jack D, was
unashamedly ripped off.
Complete rip-off.
Yeah.
But not as good. No. It really annoyed me.
No. I love Jack D. But that was... I mean, it was literally like he just made it for people that hadn't watched Curb Your Enthusiasm. Because anyone that had, you just watch it and go, well, you've stolen everything.
Yeah.
It's we're talking about that structure idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In Lead Balloon, he's done that. He's gone, oh, I see what Larry David's done here, so I'm going to do it, but not quite as well, because Jack D's brain hilarious, but he's not quite got the brain that David has, I think, for comedy.
Yeah, and you've got to have an extraordinary skill like David. Yeah. I mean, he is a historical figure of writing and comedy, but kind of American culture as well. I think we should probably acknowledge a couple of things just before we move on to one of our other kind of No Hugging, No Learning sitcoms, in that, the story's about nothing, but essentially, with Curb Your Enthusiasm, you're always feeling quite sorry for Larry David because he deals with things badly, but he never has bad intentions, he always screws things up.
Yeah.
Kind of in a kind of Alan Partridge-y kind of way, or a tragic figure like David Brent, or, you know... That's not new. It's the way and the style that it's done is new, and the structure is fresh. Jerry Seinfeld is kind of that, but I don't feel as knowingly.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of horrible, a horrible character in Seinfeld, as made famous by the ending, you know, the season finale part two.
They end up in prison, don't they?
They're all in court for not helping a guy who was mugged.
Yeah.
They were taking bets and talking about it instead.
Yeah.
And the judge said, I can't believe you witnessed this mugging and didn't help. This is aiding and abetting. And right up until the sentence where they actually get flung in jail, they're still completely unaware that they're the bad guys. Completely still being selfish, still being horrible, having learnt nothing from 9 years of...
And I think you get all the guest stars of the 9 years come onto the stand and do character witness
and they all say, this is all horrible things people, they've done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerry Stiller, I think, comes back.
Yeah, Because
he's in it, but Ben Stiller's dad. He's literally been in every sitcom in the world, I think.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that about Jerry Stiller, because obviously he then went on to be in King of Queens, the Kevin James sitcom. Which is sort of very similar to Everyone Loves Raymond, and there was a slew of those kind of sitcoms back. And what's odd is, talking about the evolution of the No Hugging, No Learning sitcom, was it wasn't a sort of immediate kind of evolution from Seinfeld. You almost saw this pushback to what Seinfeld was.
Yeah.
With shows like... In fact, Ray Romano talks about wanting to make a show that was opposite in every way of Seinfeld.
And it is including it's not
very
funny.
Highly structured.
Sorry, I watched that show every day before I went to school. I've seen a lot of it, and it never ever once made me laugh.
I have to admit, I used to love King of Queens. And I think that's more because they had good. I don't think it was that great writing, but Kevin James is a very charismatic.
It's not clever comedy, but it's well executed.
And also, you've got the brilliant Patton Oswalt, who I still think is weird that he was in that.
It is. If you look at his stand up now, you become so worthy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's when kind of, you know, it was just a lot of fat jokes. Yeah. I think is what I remember. But then Just Shoot Me again was one of those.
Yeah.
I know too much about, watch too much of that.
Yeah.
But again, a Christopher Lloyd one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so again, pushback from that. And then, of course, Friends, which we've kind of touched upon briefly.
Yeah, and I mean, again, Friends taking the model of the kind of ensemble group of friends living in New York.
Making their way through life, and it's not quite going the way, and it's a bit difficult, but it's okay.
And I suppose you could argue that, although it's not that nothing happens in Friends, that kind of idea of the sort of minutiae of daily life is explored, but there is a huge amount of character development. and there's a huge amount of hugging.
Huge
Friends. Yeah. So yeah, it's. I think there are influences that you can see in Friends from Seinfeld, but I wouldn't class it as a no hugging, no learning sitcom at all.
I would say elements, but it very much follows a traditional structure of situational comedy, and did it better than perhaps any other traditional sitcom in the history of American television. I don't think there is a joke for joke, performance for performance, better quality body of work when it comes to situation comedy than Friends. I think it's really hard to... Oh, and that's not saying it's my favourite, but objectively, it's just phenomenal.
And it's come to define... our generation, it's come to define millennials in terms of that you would be very, very hard pressed to find anyone within our age bracket that would not get a quote from Friends or know what, you know. It's something, and there's very few pieces of pop culture out there that define globally a whole sort of two decades of people.
And it's something amazing. That also my dad, you know, would come home. He used to work away a lot and come home, and a Friday night at 9 p.m. was Friends, and on Channel 4, I think. And we'd sit down, and Dad would always be like, "Oh yeah, definitely going to watch Friends." And you know, he was always like considered, it was good enough for everyone to watch. It was never just filler.
Yeah.
And I think maybe some of the millennials, or some of the generation below that, was it Generation Y?
We're generation Y,
millennial.
Gen X.
Gen X is above, but the generation kind of below us, a lot of people are re-watching
Gen Z.
Gen Z, sorry. They're discovering, if I knew the alphabet,
it would have helped, yeah.
But I don't think they might not realise that it was really something that everyone watched together. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the last things that I think really happened that way.
Yeah.
Because people don't watch television together anymore.
No.
It's just all online and streamed. But that was, it was written very much for that as well. So
it's like I remember going into school, like the day after it would be on here in the UK. And I have a specific memory of going in the day after the, I think it was like the Joey with his man's bag.
Yeah.
And hearing loads of different kids with separate situations and all these guys being like, "It's a man's bag," with their school bags and stuff.
Yeah.
And you just don't get that anymore. I think because of TV on demand and streaming services and things like that, you don't get so much that we had Tiger King last year, which was a big kind of cultural thing where people all watched the same thing, but it wasn't the same. People weren't watching it at the same time or at the same speed because of binge watching now, and you get seasons released all at the same time. You don't have those kind of water cooler moments, which is something else. Again, talking about Seinfeld, I was reading a lot about in America. You know, it was like it was on a Thursday evening on NBC, and the day after, the offices all around the country would be talking about what happened on Seinfeld the night before, which was nothing, but they'd still be talking about it.
So I think probably moving on through the kind of evolution of it, you have Seinfeld, you have Curb Your Enthusiasm, but you also have this kind of crop of slightly new, fringy, alternative kind of shows that are quite low budget, taking that mantle and really running with it.
Well, just kind of before we go into the kind of more recent crop, because it is odd that I think that the legacy of Seinfeld took a while to kind of embed, and almost you wonder if maybe it was a thing that these TV writers and directors kind of discovered slightly later than when it was actually originally broadcast, and sudden, because it feels like it's really from kind of the late noughties, like 2006-07 onwards, is really, you know, 8 years after Seinfeld ended, you started to see the change of kind of, you say, alternative comedy. But before we kind of go into that, I just want to talk about one more thing that's predates just Seinfeld, but certainly ran concurrently and is still running today, and that's of course The Simpsons.
Ah, yes.
Because although I
taking
think
that family nucleus idea and turning it on its head slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you could call it a no hugging, no learning sitcom, other than the fact that the characters very rarely change beyond episodes.
Yeah,
everything is largely self-contained.
It's always self-contained.
So, you know, Homer will learn something in an episode, that will immediately be forgotten by the next episode.
And it's never referenced. The past and the future is never referenced as things that exist. It's always about the moment that they're in.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking about it because I've read something the day before yesterday that the latest episode of The Simpsons that aired in America last week was a flashback episode, and it was flashing back to Homer as a teenager, but he was a teenager in the 90s because of where we are now.
Yeah.
And a lot of people on Twitter got up in arms about it and said, no, but, you know, he was a teenager in the 70s because that's what we saw growing up. And so one of the writers had to kind of come out and say, look, I can't believe I have to come out and say this, but it's not real. And we've said from the beginning that The Simpsons is not canon. And, you know, he said, if all the things that have happened since 1988 have happened to one family, they'd all be in a mental institution because yeah. That's a lot of weird, really dramatic things to happen to one family every week, you know. So he said it's absolutely...
fell into a volcano of soup in a Japanese game show.
Yeah, exactly. So he said it's always meant to be subversive. They can always retcon things. They can always change past events and subvert that because it doesn't exist outside of that half an hour, which kind of leads to this thing of like it's all ultimately meaningless, and which what makes me think of The Simpsons being in that conversation.
It's like an existential approach that Larry David has to all life being meaningless and human, you know, pursuit of happiness being essentially futile exercise.
Yeah,
that you get in loads of Seinfeld, certainly loads in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah. But actually, oddly enough, very much the attitude of Simpson writers, who are largely a group of scientists, you know, a lot of them are, you know, very into kind of science, despite it also being quite honouring of American Christianity and kind of Judeo-Christian moral compasses and that kind of thing. I suppose it is that existential meaningless nothingness that is, it's just about the moment, right?
Yeah.
And what you do with those moments and how you make those moments, you know, best for you, which in itself is some great advice.
yeah, absolutely.
Really nice to mention that. Adore The Simpsons, as you know.
But
yes, when we look at kind of moving it on, I think another programme that you introduced to me that I adore and we rewatched an episode of this evening is It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is probably the most obvious sort of offspring of Seinfeld out there in terms of it's a group of unlikable characters and they have taken unlikable and run with it because they are the worst. The worst. I mean, if you've not seen Always Sunny, what are you doing? But if you haven't, imagine just the absolute worst sociopathic, abhorrent people in the world. And it's just them in Philadelphia running a bar. And again, most episodes are largely about nothing and very little happens. And they certainly have not changed, with the exception of Mac and his discovery of his sexuality.
Yes.
Which is a huge series arc, 10-13 series arc storyline that is that the germs are laid from season 1 and doesn't actually come to fruition until about season 12. So that's a phenomenal character journey that he has. But aside from that, no one actually changes or learns anything.
It's kind of relentless. Yeah. In that sense, one of the things I like about It's Always Sunny, we watched the episode where it's the gang
give Frank an intervention.
There you are,
season 5. It's one of my favorites.
Frank is deciding to push himself to the edge to see how quote unquote weird he can get with his reckless behavior. So he's drinking more, he's carrying a gun, he's trying to have kind of morally ambiguous sex with sometimes family members. He's you know, absolutely caning it. Frank being played, of course, by the great Danny DeVito in what I described earlier as the performance of his life. Which is such a weird thing to say because he's been in so many hit Hollywood films. Yet, in my opinion, the greatest acting he does, both comedic and dramatic, is in It's Always Sunny.
Yeah.
I don't know why he's in that show. I remember saying to you, why is he in that show? And you said there was a kind of story about him just liking it.
Yeah, because he's not in the first season. So I believe the pilot, if I remember this story correctly, of Always Sunny, was shot, I believe, for
13,000 or something?
No, like in the hundreds.
Oh, really? It was expensive?
No. In the hundreds
of dollars.
Oh,
wow.
It was like $138. Oh, my goodness. Like, it was great. It was like the price of however much it cost, like, rent one camera. Like, because...
Wow.
Because they were all friends at university, and they kind of, just got together and made the pilot. And,
wow.
And, it's amazing.
so a real labor of love.
Went, yeah, and then sold it to FX. Who are a channel that seem to have massively embraced the No Hugging, No Learning.
Yes, I'm going to talk about another of their shows.
Yeah, a lot of their output. And Danny DeVito saw it and kind of got in touch with them and said, I love this show and let's make it happen. And then, yes, it came in from season two as their father, maybe not. Not quite sure which one of their dads he actually is. He could be all of their dads. It's all very...
No one really knows.
Confusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But as this kind of multi-millionaire, no one's really quite sure how it's never really explained, but he's got seemingly an endless supply of money. So ends up coming in to kind of bankroll all these schemes. And that's what then the series becomes about, really. Every episode is some sort of scheme or adventure that they get on that, again... they don't learn anything from it, sort of just happens, and then by the end of the episode, more often than not, what happens is they just got bored of it,
yeah,
or just changed their mind of what they wanted to do, or it's not gone their way, and so it's just forgotten about and dropped, and
yeah,
they're exactly the same the next episode. So yeah, absolutely a No Hugging, No Learning.
To the point where in that episode, with regards to Frank's intervention, they go to a kind of counselor who says, "Oh, you know, can they for advice?" And they pay her for a consultation. Say, "Can you help us? We're gonna, you know, need to save our friend Frank." And she's like, "Well, what you need to do is this." And they're like, "Oh no, we're not gonna do any of that. Actually, we think we've worked it out. Thanks for your time anyway." And they leave.
Yeah.
And they bring this character back in. So the writers are bringing in a character who wants them to literally learn and hug.
Yeah.
And that is the only sole purpose of this therapist.
Yeah.
And the characters are fighting to make that not happen.
Yeah.
And I think that is essentially the magic formula for It's Always Sunny, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You see that time and time again. There's a recurring character of a lawyer who comes in and each time gets more and more exasperated because, again, he's, trying to find some kind of normality to this situation and can't do it, and can't get them to learn and hug, as you say, very astutely. But I think the highlight episode, and I can't remember the exact title of it, in terms of really, and this Tristan, who is obviously one of our patrons that we've mentioned quite a lot of times, he said this to me. He's a huge Sunny fan as well, and he said quite rightly that the best episode in terms of what the whole show is about is the gang, I think it's called like the gang gets held hostage or the gang gets taken hostage or something like that.
Yeah.
Because the entirety of it, they get taken hostage by this rival family called the McPoyles. and they spend the whole episode basically trying to backstab each other, and rivalries kept getting ignited and then alliances formed and then broken when they think it benefits them more. And it's like totally five utterly selfish, remorseless sociopaths
with no loyalty
to each other at all, which is obviously completely breaks the convention of a group of friends in a sitcom, because they absolutely do not care about each other in any way.
And that
in terms of what Sunny's about, that's a brilliant episode to start with. It's quite an early one, I think.
I also love It's Always Sunny. I don't know if it's a cop out saying this, but I really like its politics.
Oh yeah.
Even though it's a show that it is about a bunch of lawless, moralless, you know, non-lesson learning, non-hugging psychopaths, it has a really, really great social conscience embedded in the writing. Mm-hmm. And they talk about some really interesting stuff, whether that's sexuality, whether it's about addiction, whether it's about racism, when with the episode the gang turns black.
Yeah.
Which is an incredibly clever episode. I mean, even just saying it, I feel like slightly dangerous, because yeah. a title on its own like that can be very provocative, but I promise you it's provocative for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
If you want to learn about systemic racism, that's a great way of introducing yourself to it.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean,
and I think... a phenomenal cameo from Scott Bakula.
Oh my goodness me! What, I mean, any cameo from Scott Bakula is brilliant. But yeah, there's literally nothing bad to say about it, and I can't believe that there hasn't been like a duff episode.
No.
In it's what has been
phenomenal.
What 100 years it's been running now. It's always how it's, long?
I think I lose track. I think we're on season 14. Which
so it started in 2005.
Crazy. Yeah,
and it's been going every year.
Yeah,
since then.
Yeah. So I think 14 was the last one because we didn't get one last year because of the pandemic. Yeah. So yeah. And they keep getting renewed like 3 seasons at a time. Like it's crazy.
What's that interview with the...
Oh, Glenn Howerton, yeah, who plays Dennis and is one of the creators of it, said, yeah, he thinks the only reason is that FX haven't, like, just they're not aware that it still exists and that they've never stopped the checks. Yeah. Like, it's like, that's all, because it's been years since we've ever talked to anyone at FX.
They just let them make it.
Yeah.
That's that. Yeah. I think also that... The writing, again, the structure is always there. They'll always give someone, that someone will come into the episode to try and make them write, and they'll push them away. That is always your act marker in a Sunny episode. But also, they seem to... Any comedy, right, is rooted in raging against the machine, as I often have said too many times in this one episode, so anyway, isn't it? But railing against something, normally authority, right? Mm-hmm. And when you look at Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, these comedians are constantly described by comic critics as Jewish comedians. The style and genre of humour is Jewish comedy. And this goes back to literally the Torah in terms of, religious stories, the way in which the Jewish religion, Ashkenazi Jews talk about authority and railing against it is always done with a sense of irony and satire. Irony and satire, the two pillars of Jewish comedy. And normally, always kind of poking fun at people who are either in or like in the in crowd or in positions of popularity or financial privilege, including also other Jewish people, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of born out of this the Christianization of Jewish culture, right? And then, of course, we've seen through the hundreds and thousands of years of oppression of Jewish people, whether it be in Russia, in Germany, obviously, with the Holocaust, but people moving over from the 1880s to America. Yeah. This Jewish-American style of humour is very specific, and it's railing against authority. And I can see that absolutely in Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that they've taken that idea and put it on its head, because they're no longer the people in positions of... They're actually the people in positions of privilege, especially when you look at Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah. Yeah.
He ends up satirizing himself.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful, beautiful example of how the evolution of Jewish comedy, which I think is important to touch upon when talking about the evolution of No Hugging, No Learning.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about the ethnicities, nor do I particularly care about people in It's Always Sunny. But I think it's interesting when you think about how that has moved on. The authorities that they're railing against are the people who are meant to be giving them kind of moral guidance and like the well-to-dos, the people who follow the rules, right? Yeah. What are the rules?
Is
the constant question constantly being asked in It's Always Sunny. And it kind of, maybe some of you might think this is a bit of a stretch, but I think It's Always Sunny always points out the ridiculousness of one human being telling another that they've got their lives sorted and you should be like them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's a relentless, there's a refusal there to go. Immediately someone says, I know what I'm talking about. the gang go, nah, absolutely not interested in you, because they smell it. And there's something really joyous about that, because as a viewer watching it, I'm like, yeah, everyone keeps saying they know what they're talking about, and they're just making it up as well. At least we know we're moralless, you know, rudderless human beings. Yeah. And there's something charming about that, and I think that's what gives it longevity.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry, I had to work a lot of that out loud, but hopefully it's...
No, yeah, makes total sense. Makes total sense. And I think, yeah, the idea that they are... they think that they're much bigger and better, and like they imagine they're protagonists in a sitcom, but what we actually see are really low down, terrible, awful people in a tragedy.
Yeah.
But they're in a sitcom in their minds, but that's not really what we're watching, which is really interesting.
If we
subversion of what you expect to watch.
If we took away that weird theme tune, da, 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 which is like a weird drunken fairground waltz, like a carousel demented from the from a horror film.
Yeah.
Then I think it would be Boys in the Black, so it would be a gritty drama about a really dysfunctional group of people. Maybe that's what maybe that's what we should do. We should adapt Boys in the Black stuff. It was a slip of the tongue earlier, right? But now I think I'm a genius.
I've
hit it.
We're gonna do a Boys in the Black stuff remake, but it's gonna be a comedy.
Perfect.
Brilliant. Sorted. BBC, hit us up.
I'll expect the check in the post.
Absolutely. We then kind of, you've got, obviously, the landscape of comedy then in the mid-noughties through to the kind of 2010s and where we are now today. I think you see that Seinfeld influence in things like Always Sunny and things like Arrested Development. I think you could maybe say there are elements in things like The Office and Parks and Rec, although there is a lot of characters learning things, and those shows I think have a lot more heart than maybe the more kind of cynical shows that we're going to be talking about today, but in terms of subverting the kind of tropes of sort of post-war through to the end of kind of Reagan's America sitcoms, that's certainly there.
And I love Greg Daniels' Parks and Rec and what he did with The Office, The American Office, is great. But you're right, there is an arc, especially over the course of those series, to the point where those series have to run out, right? They have to kind of end at points.
Exactly. And I suppose they have given themselves an out in terms of creating something Seinfeldian, but it has to be, in essence, a bit about nothing because it's framed as a documentary. So if you're framing something as being quote unquote real life, it can't be as exciting as a fictional piece of television. Otherwise it looks unbelievable if you're making a documentary.
Exactly.
So with mockumentary stuff anyway, you're imposing a structure that means in some way you have to make it more realistic. And as such, that means you kind of get rid of the kind of sentiment and the drama a little bit.
I mean, if you take the original kind of traditional sitcom model of everyone being in a, you know, centering around a household or a flat, like, why are all these strangers coming in and out of this house at the moment? It's the classic Stephen Jeffries, great writer on playwriting, always says, whatever you do, if you need to get a character in or out of a room, please don't have someone say, oh, I came in, the door was open. So if I hear I'm not going to read the rest of your play.
Yeah.
Because but that's, of course, the model of every American sitcom, right?
Yeah.
Is that people are just, funneling in and out. And you can't do that with a mockumentary.
Yeah.
So you've got to put people in slightly more exciting situations, more creative situations.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
Now, we do have a couple more shows to talk about, I know. One of which being possibly my favourite sitcom of all time. But just before we get there, being British, I just wanted to just talk a little bit about whether we do think this trope is particularly prevalent in UK sitcoms, and if so, which ones. Now, for me, the one that jumps out immediately is Spaced.
Yes, okay. I mean, nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
They get high.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They get high in a...
yeah,
in a room on a sofa. All I can think of with space is that sofa.
Mm.
I can't re- and the staircase.
Yeah,
because of the landing.
Mark Heap, Brian downstairs.
Yeah,
he's excellent.
Just hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah,
but yeah, but again, yeah, nothing. I can't tell you much about that.
Other than that, I know Edgar Wright's idea was that every episode sort of stylistically mimicked a different genre of movie.
Right.
But other than that, in terms of plot, no, you're right, absolutely. It's the most mundane, nothing plots every episode. But it's a work of genius, and we wouldn't get have Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz or any of that without it.
Certainly wouldn't. And those movies wouldn't be as good had it not come from a team who completely always commit themselves to well-rounded characters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like as you say with all of these things, right, a couple of rules give you a lot, you know, a few restrictions but huge amounts of freedom.
Yeah.
And I love that. I always think it's a brilliant fact of kind of art life, really, is that often when restrictions are put in place on artists, especially if you go to certain corners of the globe where there are laws and mm-hmm. limits about what you can and can't put on television, like the UK, for example, you can't do left-wing comedy anymore.
No,
cancelled by the BBC.
That's done.
Thanks for that. But often it breeds creativity. With people like Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, you've got this incredible and Hines as well. You've got this incredible commitment to well-rounded characters. Now, I don't mean like they're well-rounded people. They might be completely not well-rounded people, but the characters are really well drawn. Each yeah. character knows exactly what they're doing. We were watching a series recently with Nick Frost. I can't remember the ghost busting.
Oh, Truth Seekers.
Amazon,
yeah.
And I was just watching that going, how good is Nick Frost, yeah. man? Like, everything about that character is thought about. He knows what that guy had for breakfast that morning.
Yeah.
Like, everything yeah. is there. And it means that you don't have to take them on this crazy adventure necessarily. If you do, great. But if yeah. you don't, then also we're happy to watch them get high on a sofa
yeah.
because those characters are so well drawn. I mean, you know, we all... I mean, we're not from this generation, but you know, perhaps people like your sister, for yeah. example, friends of mine who are slightly older, you know, always at different points to be like, oh, I'm the Simon Pegg person. Oh no, you're yeah, such yeah, a yeah. Mark Heap person. You're yeah. Brian, you know, or
yeah.
the chain smoking landlady. Like,
yeah.
it was they could relate to them, and I think that's because they're also great actors, and that's what makes yeah these movies, Edgar Wright movies, so much better. I think.
Yeah,
really nice shout. Don't think you do see a lot of No Hugging, No Learning in British comedy, really.
No. I mean, Peep Show.
Peep
maybe?
Show, yeah. Yeah, actually, that's pretty good. But you do... It feels like they're going somewhere.
Yeah.
But then yeah. I suppose... And they do, but it just never really works out.
Yeah.
But they do carry it forward.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not self-contained. There is an arc over it. But it wouldn't have to be.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the one... where Jasper Carrot marries into an Indian family. That's
oh my goodness, that was a horrible thing that happened, wasn't it?
It's the worst. It's the worst, possibly the worst sitcom ever made. It's either that or that one Frank Skinner did where he plays like a taxi driver or something.
That was weird.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
that
awful.
Was a mistake.
That's awful. Well, Shane, I think it was called
Shane.
That was dreadful.
Yeah. Citizen Khan's pretty awful.
Oh God, yeah, Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Mrs. Brown's Boys is become an insult on Twitter. I love that.
Yeah.
Like, he's the type of person who might like Mrs. Brown's Boys. Yeah, it is pretty awful.
We used to be good at comedy in this country. Do you remember Monty Python?
Yeah.
Remember
Monty Python, Spike Milligan.
Fawlty Towers. Not the 9 o'clock news.
Oh, I had a record of Not the 9 o'clock news.
Genius.
I used to listen to an LP, an actual vinyl record of it. My dad had, and I used to listen to it. And as a result, I sometimes walk around the house, find myself singing "I Like Trucking." yeah.
But yeah. Now it's awful. It's all terrible. We can't do comedy anymore.
Well, I think we could, but you know, then. It's hard, isn't it?
Mm.
We don't have a culture of actually wanting to concentrate for more than about 2 seconds before we hear a bum or a toilet joke, or you know, that's kind of where it's headed in this country. But America is leading the way, as it always has done on sitcoms and many other wonderful parts of entertainment as well.
Absolutely. So when we got this request through, I immediately turned to you and said, you know what this means? It means we get to talk about a show that we adore, that about five people in the world have seen, I think.
Yeah, I think, but probably more people have listened to this podcast than have watched You're the Worst.
But You're the Worst, again, it might well be bigger in America than it is. I don't actually think it's been aired here. Oh, no, it was on Channel 5, weirdly.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it aired on Channel 5.
Who at Channel 5 went, yeah, that's the show for our guy.
Right?
Really interesting
program. But they do program some interesting stuff, Channel 5, these days. They're not boobs and Hitler anymore so much.
No.
They
are kind of still a bit boobs and Hitler. Not so much the boobs.
No.
Hitler, less the boobs.
But, yes, so You're the Worst is a wonderful, wonderful situational comedy. Created by Stephen Falk.
Yeah.
I think, what was it, 2016? Somewhere around there.
It was exactly 2014. I was teasing you like a game show host.
You did.
There you are.
You did.
Yeah. Like Chris Tarrant teasing you with a check. We're not going to give you that. 2014, Stephen Falk. Okay. So this, Stephen Falk had been writing.
Yeah.
On Orange is the New Black.
Yes, yeah.
Right, I was doing some learning. Mm-hmm. And I loved Orange is the New Black.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, right.
I don't think I actually saw the end of it, but it has ended now, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. A brilliant, brilliant series. Wonderful ensemble acting. Brilliant writing. And you can kind of see why they'd hire someone like Stephen Falk after seeing what he did on his own. But a very, very traditional kind of drama. With elements of comedy in it, sure, Orange is the New Black, but it's, you know, it's a classic kind of American drama, big budget. You're the Worst is pretty removed from that. The only thing that's similar is that I know intelligent people were behind both things. I don't. That's it. That's the only similarity.
Yeah,
is that there had to be smart people in both of those rooms.
Yeah,
the fact that they were the same people I find really bizarre.
Yeah,
but. How would you describe You're the Worst?
I was about to ask you that.
Okay.
So it's ostensibly a four seasons, wasn't it?
Finished in 2019.
Yeah, a four season long anti-love story that follows the two kind of worst humans on the planet is the sort of tag of it. However, they're kind of the quote unquote the worst humans because they're probably the two most realistic people you've ever seen in any sitcom, especially American television, because they are not idealized television versions of people. They're legitimately real people to the point of Aya Cash, who plays Gretchen, I think the best, and having had some experience of this personally with people very close to me, the most realistic portrayal of like PTSD and depression that I've ever seen on TV. And it is a sitcom, but there are these moments of rawness and moments of incredible honesty. It's a phenomenal performance by her. As it is Chris Gere and Desmond Borgers and Kevin Donahue and everyone in it is phenomenal.
You're absolutely right.
But they're real, and they're really real. They're not like, oh, he's a real, air quotes, character. And you go, yeah, it's still TV. You watch it and you go, they're absolutely recognisable, normal, real, fallible people.
And I think that is kind of what it's about. If I were to have not pipped you to the post and asked you first, I think, you know, hearing you say that, it's kind of about two central characters and their six friends, because it's like, well, is it six of them
all
together?
What if you include Paul, 4, 5, 6, 7,
Vernon, but there are eight regular characters, right? And it's kind of two of them and their six friends who trying to work out why they're so broken in different ways.
Yeah.
And trying to, in realistic kind of real time, deal with growing and developing as human beings.
Yeah.
But but falling an awful lot. And so the aim of each episode or each season cannot be about learning and hugging. It cannot be about that.
Yeah.
Because if it were, then all of these characters, you wouldn't buy it.
Yeah.
Because as you say, the performances are too real.
Yeah.
If Akash playing Gretchen at the end went, oh, and then it was all right and we all had a nice big hug in a freeze frame and everybody knows your name, you'd go, absolutely not. You've got months of therapy to deal with.
Yeah.
And Stephen Falker's writer goes, yeah, you're absolutely right. Here we go. Follow them through months of therapy. Follow them through the screw up.
Yeah.
The going on the wagon, falling off the wagon, whether it's about addiction, dealing with Desmond Borges, dealing with PTSD as a veteran and receiving very little help and falling into drug addiction and behavioural management. What happens when a marriage breaks down? Mm-hmm. You look at Vernon and Lindsay's sister. Becca. You know, how Lindsay's relationship with Alan breaks down, and so you've got it's just a mess everywhere all the time.
Yeah,
but there's also something quite uplifting about it in that these people are all determined to live despite all of this and to kind of get the most out of life, and they just try constantly. Yeah. And it's a joy. It's just an absolute joy to watch. And they managed to weave all of this and at the same time have me howling with laughter constantly.
Absolutely. What I would say is that there is one fundamental learning experience that happens at the very, very end, in the last scene of the last episode, where they are sat, I don't want to say too much because a lot of people won't have watched this and I really recommend you do, but they're sat eating breakfast in a diner and they both learn that they can't learn. And that's what they learn, that they are who they are and they're the people they are. And that's really the only main learning experience of the whole four seasons, is that they both work out that it's fine to be who they are and fallible people and real people. And actually they that's it. And there's nothing really more to that. So it's kind of, it is a learn, but again, it's kind of subverting the idea of learning.
It's acceptance.
Yeah.
Which is not the same as learning and getting better or developing. It's actually being okay with who you are.
Yeah.
And being at peace with that, which if you're Jimmy and Gretchen, is not necessarily the right thing to do, because they really are awful human beings.
Yeah.
They meet in episode one where Gretchen, they're both at a mutual friend's wedding.
Yeah.
And Gretchen has stolen one of the bride and groom's wedding presents.
Yeah.
And Chris Gere's character Jimmy finds this so heinous that he immediately kind of falls in love with her.
Yeah.
Because it's something he wished he'd done.
Yeah.
All he managed to do was get drunk and make a bad speech, which he'd been planning to write the most upsetting speech for as many guests as possible. This is the first episode, right? This is how horrible they are. And by the end of it, they learn that they're not going to change.
Yeah.
And that's 5 years of programming.
Yeah.
But it's also beautifully shot, beautifully put together. And as a kind of piece of filmmaking, I think You're the Worst has a level of prowess that I don't think any of the other shows we've talked about has.
No, well, just kind of linking right back to Seinfeld, and we talked about that idea that you know, having only those two rules, and those two rules offering a lot of freedom structurally, you saw all those stylistically very different choices from episode to episode.
Mm.
That is something that absolutely you can see in You're the Worst, when you talk about the episode where they're at a party and the whole thing is one singular tracking shot, a la Birdman or the recent war one that Sam Mendes did.
1914.
Yeah. Is that the year?
1917.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been 1914, would it?
No. Just starting. Or you've got the episode where the entire of the episode up until the last 30 seconds is following a couple that you've never met before, and they don't explain who they are, to the point of I remember when we first watched it, and I was like, are we on the right thing? Because we've turned onto the wrong thing. Because it's a couple that you've never seen before, ever. And it's following their whole life. But it's structured as if you're in the middle of a season about these people. Because it doesn't tell you who they are, you don't, and there's no connection until the very, very end.
It's trolling.
So you're the worst.
He's being trolled by Stephen Falk.
But this idea that there's these constant shifts of tone and style and structure is very similar to Seinfeld.
Yeah, you're right. And also kind of a couple of celebrity guests. I say a couple.
And you say celebrity. I don't think Paul F. Tompkins counts as a celebrity.
He's playing himself, though.
He's playing himself. But he's not famous enough to play himself, which I think is part of the joke.
Yeah, but he's playing a realistically, accurately level of fame that he has in real life, which is...
Yeah.
Which is not great, but then also he ends up getting into scrapes.
But it's weird because you've also got Doug Benson in it, who's playing a wildly unrealistic version of his level of fame because he's playing that he's a multimillionaire that owns a huge corporate, and he's a stoner comedian that has a podcast.
Yeah.
And you're like, so you've got Paul F. Tompkins playing his accurate level of what he is, and you've got Doug Benson playing a ridiculous boardroom exec CEO version of stoner comedian Doug Benson. It's so weird.
That is bizarre. You also have Ben Folds for like 3 episodes.
Yeah.
At one point, he's just at a party.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Jimmy's at.
Yeah.
I also think one of the reasons why I enjoy You're the Worst is that it follows Gretchen, who's works in A&R in the music industry, and ends up kind of managing this up and coming hip hop band and branding and marketing their kind of thing. So she's kind of following showbiz in that sense. And Jimmy is on a mission to write the kind of great American novel, which is difficult because he's a British author living in LA.
Yeah.
And ends up getting some success with The Width of a Peach,
which
is the title of his pretentious novel. And not only do I believe they're both capable of achieving their goals, which is breaking the first rule of a sitcom, right? Yeah. How can you rail against the machine if you're actually kind of in pretty high circles, got enough money, you know, everything's going okay, your actual problems are emotional trauma? Well, that's not going to set you up for a good Friends episode. It just is not the right ingredients.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons I enjoy it is because I genuinely am interested in their artistic worlds as well. The fact that they've both got these kind of different ways of expressing, trying to express humanity, and yet completely emotionally disabled in that sense. Really, you know, really, really struggle. Makes it not only very real, but also you're constantly wanting them to succeed. But you know that probably means that it's probably not going to end well.
Yeah,
you know, if they do, which is really tough thing to watch.
Yeah.
I've just remembered, looked at my notes that I made on Stephen Falk earlier. Weeds. He was a star writer for Weeds, which makes sense. Take back what I said about the Orange is the New Black thing. They are very different, but Weeds does have a bit of ingredients. Weeds, because kind of a bit of a no-hugging, no-learning as well, in that sense. Apparently there's going to be a reboot called Weeds 420, following Mary Louise Parker.
Yeah.
And the other, I can't remember the name of the other person.
Oh, I can't.
Following them 10 years on.
That's
cool. But no date's been confirmed yet, obviously.
Yeah.
At the moment, not the greatest time to... But that'll be interesting, yeah. I'd like to see
that's cool.
Weeds 420, watch out.
That'd be great.
I mean, what else do you want to know about the no hugging, no learning?
So, yeah, I mean, I just wanted to put a final thing out there, and it kind of links back to what you were saying about Always Sunny, about you said it might sound silly but you really like the politics of it, and it spoke to something I've been thinking about doing the research for this podcast, which is, do you think that by making a show about nothing makes it easier to make a show about everything? Terms of, if you're not worrying about character and plot in the small microcosmic fictional world you've made yourself, then it leaves you free to talk about huge, wide-ranging socioeconomic, political conversations that actually end up being far deeper because of the lack of structure than imposing a structure on it that only is really about these made up people that always in the back of your mind, you know, are invented in fictional anyway in a made up world where you're asked for half an hour to invest in something they've done that's going to ultimately be meaningless anyway. So if you're actually being honest about the meaninglessness of it, then you can actually have characters like in Seinfeld, like in Sunny, like in You're the Worst, like in all these shows we've been talking about, have real conversations about real big, wide, important things in a sitcom.
Well, you're going to laugh now, right? I've seen your philosophical kind of claw into this, and I will raise you.
Okay.
I think that I can't believe I'm doing this, but if you look at something like It's Always Sunny,
yes,
and you look at Samuel Beckett,
yeah, right? Yeah,
stay yeah, with I'm me, with listeners. Don't hang on.
Sorry, just to clarify, you are talking just because we need to make sure you're talking about the playwright Samuel Beckett,
yeah,
not Dr. Samuel Beckett of Quantum Leap.
Oh no, I'm not.
Okay, good. Okay, just for the listeners, just they might have been confused.
Yeah, you're quite right. Waiting for Godot, right? Everyone talks about how, oh, isn't Samuel Beckett incredible? It's existentialism. It's all about the meaning of life, which of course is essentially nothing. No Exit, Jean-Paul Sartre. Yeah. Oh, well, it's completely about nothing. And you know, existential. Well, what they're doing in those situations is taking the form of drama, a fictionalized world where people, you know, have, there are false characters with real truths to them.
Yeah.
And then pulling that apart. So the audience are forced to step into the nothingness and the meaninglessness of it all and think about life in a bigger, more philosophical, conceptual way.
Yeah.
And I think what you're, if I'm understanding you correctly, is like by taking away the neat package of a beginning and a middle and an end and everyone kind of going from A to B and getting there with some jokes along the way, which is what traditional situation comedy is about, by taking away that structure and having the freedom to go wherever you want, you're actually allowing space for that conceptual existential discussion about what life really is, what existence really is about. And maybe that's why the politics of It's Always Sunny shine through. And I definitely think it's why the kind of the torture of what it is to be a human being, unsure of oneself and unable to self-regulate and manage one's emotions, like You're the Worst.
Mm-hmm.
That's truthfully explored. Because it has the space and time to do so. It, in fact, it isn't constrained by the rules of what is normally accepted in a traditional make me laugh and don't make me think sitcom. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, Lord, you know, talked about how important Friends is and how comforting actually a lot of people find it now. It's being watched a lot on Netflix, apparently, comfort watching. So you don't really pay attention. You just have it on in the background.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can't do that with It's Always Sunny. You're not going to do it with You're the Worst.
No.
You're not going to do it really with Seinfeld either. Because, I mean, the candle after would just make me more anxious than anything.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think it allows space for this discussion and it allows you to think about the bigger things. And that's why I come away, especially from You're the Worst, feeling like they might not have learned anything, but I have as an audience member. And I don't feel that about other sitcoms. And I think maybe that's the gift of the no hugging, no learning.
Yeah.
If Larry David sat in your head going, you know, no hugging, no learning, except for the audience, maybe that was the bit of the quote that we never heard.
I think that's the perfect place to leave.
Okay.
I'm going
to get letters now. You're going to leave leaving the whole situation, the flat, the podcast.
Yeah, everything.
It'll be me next week. I'm writing an apology podcast for making these comparisons, but yeah.
No, I think that's great. I think that's brilliant.
They're really, really lovely. Thank you for that wonderful request.
Thank you, Ben. That was excellent. Yeah. Really fun. Yeah, really nice little chat there.
What are we back with next week?
Next week, I believe we are back with Sylvan and with Moonlighting.
Now,
last time we went to Moonlighting, he got upset with us for choosing really good episodes and then being like, this series is great. So he's asked us specifically.
He got annoyed at us.
It's absolutely fair enough. We have been very selective about the episodes we've chosen. So he's suggested some that maybe don't show it in such good light and is maybe more in line with the Jonathan Creek comparisons that he originally made when he suggested it. So that will be interesting, because I have fallen in love with Moonlighting.
I don't want to watch a bad episode.
So yeah, that'll be interesting to see. And then after that we will be back with Josh talking about the much anticipated by us, by no one else.
By you and Josh.
By no one else.
I'm not even that bothered by it.
Oh, come on, you are.
You wait. I say that now. You wait till I get my heckles up.
Yeah, it is, of course, the greatest albums of 2004.
Which is going to be incredible.
Yeah. And why...
blood will be spilt over
why this. We're all choosing Sweat / Soup by Nelly.
Oh, brilliant album.
Absolutely. Double album.
Nelly did a double album.
Although I do, spoiler alert, have a double album in my top three.
No.
Leave you to think on that in the coming weeks.
Will do.
In the meantime, if you have anything to say about the No Hugging, No Learning sitcom, any that we've missed out, I think there are quite a few more that we've not had time to get into today. You know where to find us. You can drop us a line on Twitter at Macabre Podcaster. You can send us an email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. And you can, of course, like, subscribe, and share this podcast, our Jonathan Creek podcasts, all our back catalogue on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Anchor, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
In the meantime, I've been Callum Hughes.
I've been David Shopland.
We'll see you next week.
Bye. Well, must you tell me everything that's on your mind? No hugging, no learning. Sharing feelings is a waste of time. No hugging, no learning. I've got feelings too, just like everybody else. Yeah, I've got feelings too, but I keep them to myself. Well, must you tell me